I can't overstate how significant that conversational and relational space was for creating a communitas of sorts that was permission giving for a bunch of us who otherwise were fairly isolated.
So fun to do that week after week. And also, you just don't get a break because every single week is like that, you know?
And I just needed to create a space where we could abide collectively as the people of Jesus. Like, we had $10,000. That was our seed money. We just didn't have staff. We had me. And I was raising half of my salary just from people who were invested in me.
The thing that made us special is that it mattered so much to us that we all gave so much. Like, I can't think of a single person that didn't just give profusely to the life of Journey. And that's what made it so lovely.
Give us now the courage to hope with our whole hearts, to sing with our whole being, to laugh with our bellies like they're bowls full of jelly if we have to. Help us to be unashamed of this beautiful and seemingly impossible dream of a world without violence, because, dear God, we know it is the best future you have for us.
The emerging church movement was an expression of the grace of God in my life that came at a time when I was isolated and needed permission.
About every 500 years, the Latinized culture goes through a huge upheaval, and we're going through one right now. Every time that happens, whatever form of Christianity has to drop back and reconfigure, it doesn't ever cease to be.
They had a deep suspicion of hierarchy and institutionalism.
If fear is the motivation behind not dealing with those sort of in the back of your mind questions, that to me is the worst kind of faith of all. It's despair.
Welcome to Emerged, a story of young leaders who had audacious dreams, who became loyal friends, who achieved fame and influence, who burned brightly but briefly. And now, for the first time, many of the leaders reflect on their participation in the emerging church movement, and they consider the movement's legacy. Join us as we tell the tale of their successes and failures, the attacks they endured, the mistakes they made, what they left undone, and what they accomplished. Join us to hear the story of what emerged. And now, here are your hosts, Tony Jones and Trip Fuller, with producer Josh Gilbert.
I wanna find my way back home. I wanna learn to love, and I want to.
Okay, so when I was in high school, I was living in Alberta, Canada, Strathmore, Alberta, actually, and we were at an Evangelical Covenant church. My dad was a pastor of, it was about a 300-person congregation. And in my junior year, all of the cool, hip 20-year-olds at my church started a new church like 30 minutes away. And so, like, the community, like, all of the people that were above high school left to start a different church. And it was like really hard for me because it was in a gymnasium at this school where they like barely could afford it. And there was like 12 people there, but they were like the best 12 from our church, all the young people. I didn't know it at the time, but there was for sure a progressive flavor to it. And I just wonder now, that was probably like a version of an emerging church. We didn't use that language, but it was a progressive offshoot of this, you know, Evangelical Covenant church. And I was too young to go, but it really bummed me out that all of the cool hit people just left my church to start something new.
They should have called that church the Best 12 Church. Because you said they were the best 12 people from your dad's church.
Very discipleish.
Yeah, I mean, my dad stayed, so he'll be bummed to hear that because there was obviously great people at both. But it was like all of the people with tattoos, all the people that were, you know, listening to the cool bands,
yeah,
they left. And it was just me as like a, you know, 12-year-old. At the church.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's fascinating to me is so often the pictures that people know about the emerging church movement come from the figures that had a book that ended up at a conference or then, or maybe inspired people to write books and complain about them on the internet. But what I love about spending time hearing two different church planters' stories about their community is you get the actual energy of the emerging church movement. And even that example kind of points at how, yes, there was this label and these groups and these people, but that ethos that to embody the faith in a new way requires the kind of openness and newness and freshness that starting a community anew represents.
Well, I haven't given much away. Away from you, I've only floundered. And still with you are debts I paid, our every sin, your grace surrounded.
The thing I loved most about getting to talk with Tim and listening to Tony's conversation with Danielle is there's this big energy as to what it looked like to take these new ideas and perspectives seriously. The kind of wrestling with the tradition and how do you interpret it and how do you embody it. Both of them kind of insist that the hermeneutics of the gospel takes place in an embodied community. And that kind of community first as the institution that shapes discipleship versus you go read your Bible and pray. Pray this prayer by yourself, individual, salvation, transactional, entertainment, church in a box, focus on the generation. That shift really kind of required new communities. And that to me is something you miss when you're no longer a part of one of those communities anymore. And just getting to have a conversation with Tim and hearing Danielle's made me think, oh, I hope some other people think we need to get together as communities to really rework what the life of Christ could look like in the present.
I love that we've paired up these two interviews, and I think we kind of lucked into it or whatever, how well these two pair. I mean, in one sense, they're different. Tim and Danielle are different because one planted the church and the other one came in as the second pastor who followed the church planter. One grew to be pretty big. One stayed small. One is still going 25 years later. The other one shut down. So in some ways, they're different. They give us two different flavors of the journey of an emerging church that was planted in the early 2000s. On the other hand, these two complement each other so well because here's what I remember particularly about Tim and Danielle, but also about just about everyone I knew who planted a church in the movement, is that they were very theologically curious. We were constantly, all of us. Now, I was doing that more kind of for a living, but these were like pastors and church planters whose lives were very full on a day in, day out basis of running these church plants. And yet they're taking time to not only to read a lot of theology and talk to their friends about theology, but actually host theological events. Like Danielle shared the hosting duties with me when we did the theological conversation with Jürgen Moltmann. So she's sitting up in front, you know, and like talking with arguably the preeminent living theologian in the world at the time. And then Tim hosted at his church at Jacob's Well an emergent theological conversation that was called Paulophilia or Paulophobia, in which we brought in a bunch of different scholars to talk about their research on the Apostle Paul. And every emerging church pastor I knew was like that theologically curious. So that's one just thing I love about these two being paired up in this episode.
We're first going to hear from Tim. And I wonder, Tripp, for those of us that missed out on that time, and it still is currently a church, but can you kind of paint the picture and set us up for that conversation with Tim?
You know, honestly, I only visited Jacob's Well once, but knew a lot of churches and visited a number of them that were similar. In having a conversation with Tim, I think you can see the kind of heart that is at the center of so many emerging church congregations. And when you get to visit Jacob's Well in this episode, you're going to get to hear the big picture, but you also hear some really specific stories that you just can't make up and really capture the essence of what they've been doing there for 25 years now. What was the moment where Tim Keel had the energy, passion, questions, uncomfortability with what was being handed that set you in a trajectory to find friends and church plant and all that kind of stuff?
It comes out of a campus ministry I got involved in when I was in college. My folks had gotten divorced when I was a senior in high school. I pretty quickly came to faith. I'd grown up in the church, but never had really been discipled, didn't know what it really meant to follow. It was a Southern Baptist church, so it was just one rededication after another, but not a whole lot of content. When I went to college and got involved in a campus ministry, and it was student-led, it really ignited something in me. I was at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. I was an art major. I was also in a fraternity. And so I was living in a bunch of tensions that just seemed normal at the time, but I came to realize later were not normal. And we were just experiencing the seeds of a communal kind of expression of faith that was really significant. My commitment to the local church was really birthed when my family dissolved and the body of Christ became my family and restored something significant in me that was really hungry and missing. I went into ministry at this local church, and it was a great church, but the summer I came on staff, it made the turn to Willow Creek seeker targeted. I went to one of the early leaderships, and man, our senior pastor was hook, line, and sinker all in. I just remember how it was compelling, it was interesting, but it left something, it left me really empty in a way. The way I describe it is I always felt like I was preparing for a game I never played in. I came to discover that in the context of a suburban mega church, I lost my faith. And what I don't mean is I lost the content of my doctrine. I didn't lose any conviction. I lost a way of life that had been really significant for me in those 4 years at college. I knew I was called to the church, and I knew I wanted to do more than what I did. So I went to seminary, moved to Denver with my family. I realized I was having a crisis of faith, but it wasn't faith. It was crisis of church. One of the graces during that time was I got involved in a Gen X church plant called Pathways. They were doing cutting edge stuff. It was all about generational ministry. They were doing a Gen X seeker church. I was the program director, helping coordinate drama. I was leading worship. We had a band that did a relevant song. I remember one week he did a sermon on friendship and they played the Friends song, I'll Be There. I mean, it was just hook, line, and sinker. But the thing that really turned the tide for me, Tripp, was near the end of my seminary time, and near the end of my time at Pathways, you've heard of the Glen Eyrie conference that happened. Ron pulled me along and went down to this thing where I met Chris C. and Tim Selleck and Dieter Zander and the whole thing. And that was the first time I'd ever heard the word postmodern, which then ignited something in me. And it was such a moving experience. And I remember at the very end of this, from the front, Chris C. did a kind of altar call, if you will. But it was, if you feel like God has called you to reach out into this generation and to do something as crazy as plant a church, I want you to stand up. And like, I just remember physically, I was sitting down and then I was standing up, and I don't ever remember making a decision to stand up. I was just on my feet. And then before I knew what was going on, there were a ton of people around me, hands on me, and that was happening. And they were just kind of commissioning me and praying for me to do that. So it was a combination of desire to get back to something vital. I wasn't really, in a sense, trying to reach anyone as much as it was for me trying to create a community where I could rediscover a vital connection to God as a part of a community of Christ.
From your own story of the church becoming your community of closest connection and then running into conflict with the expectations of what it's supposed to look like and responding to this call, how did this new network of friends and recognition to a call, what happened between that moment and launching Jacob's Well?
You know, I was then having to go back because the church that I had been the youth pastor at then were the ones that identified me as a church planter and called me back and gave me permission to go plant off that church, which was really both a blessing and kind of a curse. The senior pastor had told his own origin story about really finding the need to want to reach out in a way that honored the church that sent him, but that he needed to do something different. But when I started articulating a difference, they really had a hard time. So I became for a while a bit of a black sheep because I was trying to articulate something that to me felt hard to name. I wanted to experiment my way into it, but I knew that worship was a part of it. I knew that beauty and art was a part of it. So it was really lonely and confusing and hard to be kind of the outsider in the community that had sent me. In that sense, the combination of people and friendships really became important. I was kind of trying to be and relate my way into a new kind of framework. So within that, the emerging community began, especially among those who were actual practitioners, there was just a host of us church planting. Right? It became this place to resource each other conversationally and then with what we were reading. And it was, of course, about things like epistemology and hermeneutics, but it was also ecclesiology. It was missiology. What's really crazy is that, you know, Jacob's Well this year will celebrate our 25th anniversary as a church. And we started on September 12th, 1999. It was also the same Sunday that Chris C. launched Ecclesia. And I think Doug was, if not on that date, right there at Solomon's Porch. And so there was something happening. There was a genesis of sorts. I can't overstate how significant that conversational and relational space was for creating a communitas of sorts that was permission giving for a bunch of us who otherwise were fairly isolated in our context.
When you get together with the first group of people and are thinking about Jacob's Well, how does that conversation work when there's not a booklet to hand out about church planting?
When we started, we had a core group of about 35 people, but we had amassed 50 to 60 people that were kind of hovering around the idea of it. There were kind of three distinct groups of people. One was, I would say they were unchurched Christians or marginally church Christians that had been connected to me in the campus ministry time and knew me as a quantifiable thing. We had a connection.
So they already trusted you.
Yeah, we had that relationship and we had done something previously together that was significant. Two, there were a few people from the church that had brought me back and was sending me. And then the other were, we made a very intentional decision to plant in a very creative part of the city at the time. People that were planting churches were planting in the suburbs. And so we went into the city. And there were a bunch of people that were living in the city intentionally, not wanting to drive to suburbs. So the third group were kind of like people committed to the community that we were going to be in. And then so that those three folks came together. I don't think people that are coming to church go to church in response to a model. They're coming because they want to connect to God. They want to be a part of a community of people that helps resource them for their lives. And they're coming for significant relationships. I had been deeply influenced by the idea of John 15, if you abide in me and I abide in you, then you will produce much fruit. And it seemed so much of what I was responding to and reacting against was the idea that we can generate fruit by being smarter than our target audience. And I just needed to create a space where we could abide collectively as the people of Jesus. Like we had $10,000. That was our seed money. You know what I mean? Like it was not, we just didn't have staff. We had me. And I was raising half of my salary just from people who were invested in me. And so we grew really slowly, which I really think was a great boon and a blessing. We only could do those things that our community could support. And that just took time. And we're sharing a building with Roanoke Presbyterian Church, which is a very old PCUSA church in the city, traditional Presbyterian red brick building, beautiful kind of architecture, dark wood, pews, the whole deal. We met them in the evening. They met in the morning. We do small groups. We did midrash. We did book discussions where we would read different things. We were doing art things. Things really shifted in 2003. I was able to hire a guy who became our worship leader, who is one of the most gifted musicians I know. He started writing our own music. He started gathering around him a community of artists that was just incredible. Mike Crawford is his name. We raised money to build a recording studio in the building. That process got underway. Then in 2003, the host church had a series of challenges that caused them ultimately to close their doors. And the guy who was the interim at the time helped us to broker a purchase of the building from the denomination. We were able to raise, with this little young church, $200,000 cash and pay cash for a building. One thing that happened, we were working with a woman in our church who was working with another woman who was helping women get off the street from prostitution. And we had that founder, it was called Veronica's Voice, come and preach one Sunday night. And when she was walking up and she had a bunch of women with her who were a part of her ministry, I had this vision of asking the women who were formerly prostitutes to be the ones to serve communion that week. And it was one of the most powerful things that had ever happened. After hearing Christy's story and then having six women stand up in front who were formerly prostitutes serving the entire church communion, it just kind of did something. Well, there was somebody from our local newspaper there that Sunday and saw that. They decided to do an article on our church that then ran 4 months later on Palm Sunday, an 8-page full color spread. And at that point, our church, we had one service. We were running 500 to 600 people. We were doing formation with small groups, all kinds of, you know, book discussions, musical kind of concert things, 80s and 90s proms on Mardi Gras. We weren't trying to reach 20 somethings, but we had this incredibly young demographic that were just hungry as all get at for community and really responding to what was happening. I preached for 45 minutes. We worshiped like 8 or 9 songs. But then in 2003, 2004, we bought the building and we added a morning service. And then we pretty quickly added another morning service because, you know, it allowed families who want to have kids at church. I mean, we grew, but growth was never the goal. Mm. Growth was a byproduct of something more vital for us. And that was, what does it look like to meaningfully abide as a community?
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. I was committed, Tripp, to the idea that as a church, we were not a collection of individuals who came together because we had shared personal preference. Mm. I was really trying to articulate to our young church, hey, we are a community first. You are called, I didn't use election language, but the normative expression of a Christian experience is collective, not personal, or not individual. I would say it's personal, not individual, but we're community first and then personal second. As a result, then your primary identity is not as a consumer, but as a disciple and as somebody with a creative will that can respond in ways that mirror the life of the Trinity. You know what I mean? And so I was really banging that drum, trying to articulate an alternate witness about what it meant to be a human being, and then how that carried over then into an idea of what it means to be the church. If we're not just a collection of individuals that are coming together to consume religious goods and services, then what are we?
You mentioned Mike's music, and as someone who at that time was stealing it for campus ministry use, Words to Build a Life On, which is one of the greatest songs of all time, unless you're trying to sing it and then it hits and then you start tearing up in the middle of it.
These are words to build a life on. These are your words. How can they be mine? These are...
There was a woman who got so into the song that when it comes, scream your freaking lungs out, she just dropped the F-bomb. And I was right in front of her. I kind of looked around and nobody seemed to be reacting. I was like, I guess that just happened. But it was just a funny thing that, you know, you knew that when she was in her car just sitting on her own, that was her practice.
Alternative, you know, glossolalia. I mean?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Mike was our first full-time hire. He's incredibly intelligent, reads like crazy, and his lyrics are theologically rich and rooted in the kind of theological framework. You don't hear a lot of Jesus is my boyfriend, nor do you hear substitutionary penal atonement. Yeah. Worship lyrics, they're theologically rich, talk about what it means to be the body of Christ, just enormous artistic chops. And then an ability to pastor an incredibly diverse group of musicians and other creators. Adding Mike to the mix just gave expression to something that was inchoate, but not incarnate yet.
So, Tim, how did your friendships with other emerging church leaders facilitate your own kind of discovery as a person and shape your imagination as you planted Jacob's Well?
Emergent was talked about as a friendship, a generative friendship among missional Christian leaders. And it's hard to overstate how significant the friendship side of it was. We were a group of people that had a lot of affinity because of our shared experience and our shared sense of calling. And so I think you can look back from the vantage point of the present and see the arc of where we went. Like first thing, like coming out of modernity, we're engaging postmodernity. Epistemology was a big thing. How do we know what we know? And that was really significant, not just on a theoretical level. When I was trying to articulate a different vision of church, we were talking about epistemology. We were talking about hermeneutics, the Bible, the arts, about architecture and aesthetics. And I mean, honestly, I miss it so much. There's nothing quite like the space that was created for about a 7-year run where theology and aesthetics and community and practice were being discussed by practitioners in a relational environment that was hospitable to people who weren't also insiders. I'm struggling to even get the words. It was catalytic. It was permission giving. It was life-changing in those ways. That kind of non-anxious permission-giving environment is so critical for creativity. We're looking in an indirect way, I think, for a new kind of connectionalism. So denominations, I think, for 400 years have been the answer to the question, what does it look like to be meaningfully connected to other bodies of believers? And largely around three issues. How do we train leaders? Okay, we'll have denominational seminaries. How do we empower leaders? We'll ordain them. And then how do we keep them accountable? When something goes wrong, we have books of order where we know how to discipline people, right? But those aren't the issues anymore. You can get credentialed anywhere. You can get trained anywhere. The kind of polity things that are going on are as problematic as they are helpful. So things like the Willow Creek Association came up as a new kind of connectionalism around strategic mission, where you share a set of kind of parachurch commitments to something like evangelism, and then you remake the church in response to best practices. That's not ecclesiology. And so I think Emergent was trying to create another kind of space for belonging. And one of the things that made it a high level of trust is no one had any power over each other. It was opt-in. You remember the old P.D. Eastman book where the baby bird falls out of the nest and then walks around and says, "Are you my mother?"
Yeah.
I feel like for the first 5 years of our church, that's what I was doing, walking around, you know, looking at different denominational options because I really do believe in connectionalism. Ironically, because we were independent and non-denominational, Jacob's Well was attractive to and attracted a wildly diverse community. I mean, we have Catholics, Orthodox, Southern Baptists, we have Nazarene. People coming into our church have such a wide framework and are often coming to us being really wounded.
In shifting away from an individual-focused form of the faith, how did that reshape the nature and role of worship?
To me, the normative place of formation is community and not personal. Practices are best and most significantly forming collectively. My evangelical heritage told me the most important thing were my personal pietistic practices, quiet time, Bible reading, prayer, all those fasting, all those things. So when I shifted gears and said, the most significant and formative practice in my discipleship is my weekly participation in corporate worship. I had grown up in an evangelical framework where the worship gathering was not a worship gathering. It was event space. And it wasn't an altar. It was a stage. You know what I mean? And just for example, do adult men gather and sing unless they're intoxicated and in a concert? And then sing lyrics that undermine imperial imaginations and describe God's care for the poor and the vulnerable and that invite us into a reconciling posture towards God and our neighbor and the least of these, and to do it with beauty. Where does that happen? Because I know for me, singing short circuits something in my cognitive process that I need short circuited. It gets me in my body in a way that almost nothing else does. When you've got a whole community of people that are likewise with you and you're singing louder than the band, when the congregation is still louder than that, it's extraordinary. And then you preach and you tell an alternate narrative about what it means to be a human being in a world that God loves and is created with joy and affection and is reconciling. Then you embody that thing by immediately going into a Eucharistic celebration where you say, hey, here's the pattern for your life. You are to be taken, blessed, broken, and given, just as Jesus himself was taken, blessed, broken, and given. And you get up out of your seat and you walk to the front and you take a piece of bread and you dip it in a cup and you taste and see that the Lord is good. You know what I mean? And you sing a benediction, holding hands with your neighbor and reaching across an aisle. That begins to shape, you know, maybe it's only an hour to an hour and a quarter once a week. But if you do that, let's just say 40 times a year, it's deeply empowering of an alternative imagination. So to me, it starts with that. Like, what are the things that we do collectively? How do we understand the worship gathering as a practice that narrates an alternative reality and that gives shape to an imagination that then empowers us to live differently in the lives we have at home, in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces?
If you're about to give an invitation to go plant a church, I'm worried I might just jump right out of the seat.
Well, I mean, like, so Tripp, it just occurred to me, saying all that, it becomes a bit of a microcosm of what I talked about emerging being for me. So when we would have these events, whether they were theology conferences or what, we'd come together and we'd do these conversations and have these practices that would then empower us to go back and minister in the places. And I'm saying worship can be like that for a person who comes to church. They come in and they're connected to people who they otherwise in their life might not ever see or connect to. And they are given a narrative that is good news, even better than they guessed, about how deeply and truly they known and loved they are, how they have the possibility of experiencing love in such a way that would even cause transformation from the inside out, and not just of them personally, but the world that we're a part of. It begins to create the possibility of hope for people, you know, as opposed to just another week. Last December, we had a Wednesday night gathering called Watch for the Light. Advent is meant to be preparation and making space. to receive the Christ. And so we had these very intentional, slow spaces that involved music, but also 5 minutes of silence and invitational reflection on your life. And it culminated on December 22nd with the longest night of the year service, where people feel oppressed by what they're supposed to be feeling at Christmas time, and they don't have a corresponding space to reckon with loss. And so we had this thing where we had five different people get up and share the loss that they'd experienced in the last year. Trip, the church is called to teach people how to die and die well. And our baptismal sacrament is the first introduction to that idea. But if our liturgical practices are only constantly about success and acquisition and accumulation of positive experiences, there is no way that in December, on Wednesday nights for consecutive weeks, our church should have been packed, given what people's schedules are like in the month of December. But giving people space to be still, to grieve, and to mourn publicly and in community was one of the most powerful things I've ever experienced.
In 25 years of journeying with the people at Jacob's Well, how have you come to understand our current spiritual crisis and the challenge of finding embodied communities with integrity?
That is such a good articulation of a very complex reality. And I think we're in crisis. I do. I really do. Starting with the 2016 election and some of the ways that that exposed us, and then the pandemic, I just think we're in some challenging space. I don't know, Trip. I mean, I don't want to use the judgment of God in a God as Zeus, but the idea that we're reaping what we've sown and that there was going to come a day the bill came due, you know, for what like Dallas Willard 20 years ago was calling a vampiric relationship with Jesus, where we want him for his blood and not much else. But I do feel concerned about the state of faith in the environments where I'm exposed to it. And I don't know any answer to it except pastoring my local church.
So what if somebody in your congregation now who has no reference point for the emerging church listens to this and pulls you aside and says, Tim, what was the emerging church movement and how is it connected to what we do?
The emerging church movement was an expression of the grace of God in my life that came at a time when I was isolated and needed permission, theological permission, methodological permission, and relational permission to act out the calling I knew I had in my heart. And the only way that I got permission in all of those areas was through the extraordinary friendship of a bunch of diverse people that came together for this small window of time in a way that was transformational. I mean, I don't even know if we've mentioned people like Anthony Smith, Postmodern Negro, Karen Ward, mm-hmm. Rudy Carrasco, Holly Roach, mm-hmm. Ivy Beckwith, just so many extraordinary people. Tim Condor, so many people, Doug, Chris, Brian, Al Roxburgh. I just have friends all over this world that I could call and be on their couch tonight if I needed to. And I don't know how that happens except from the grace of God.
Boy, Tim and I go back a long, long way, and he was obviously a part of the very early days of what became Emergent Village, and his church is one of the real success stories of the movement, frankly. When we come back from the break, it's my turn to interview a pastor of an emerging church, Danielle Schroyer, who is the pastor of Journey in Dallas. I'll tell you a bit more about her after these messages. And friends, two things. You don't want any more ads? Join at emergedpodcast.com. Become a member. You will get ad-free episodes, plus all sorts of other bonus material. Plus, this is it. Last call for a coffee mug that says, I have emerged, along with our Leaf logo. Please, if you want one of those mugs, this is the week. On the 15th, that's the cutoff date, March 15th, and then we're going to put in our order. Same goes for the pins. Thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be right back.
I thought you knew me all the long. With the word I proved you wrong.
Hey friends, if you want to hang out with us, then consider coming to Theology Beer Camp this October in Denver, Colorado. You'll not just get to hang out with us. There'll be 20 or so different podcasts. There'll be 20 or so different scholars, theologians, biblical scholars and such. And there'll be hundreds and hundreds of people who like asking big questions and aren't sure where, how together to do it. If you want to be a part of that, come taste the fun and delicious craft beverages. Come to camp, theologybeer.camp. Check it out, and we'll see you there.
In The God of Wild Places, Tony Jones opens up for the first time about what pushed him out of the church and into the woods. And he explores the spiritual insights he's gained in wild places about place and peace, about risk and failure, about predators and death. Brian McLaren says, I love this book. I love its honesty, its tenderness, its craft, its settings, its quests and questions, and the profound mysteries toward which it bows. It takes you places you need to go. The God of Wild Places by Tony Jones is available wherever books are sold.
I don't remember the first time I met Danielle Schroyer, but I definitely remember the first time that I visited Journey Church in Dallas. It was at its original location. It was a small collective of people, but as you'll hear in my conversation with Danielle, a group of people who were passionately committed to one another. Like, unlike any church I've ever seen, I think probably unlike a lot of families, I mean, really, truly connected to one another. And it was a beautiful thing to see. Danielle, as we said in the intro, has a very different story into her emerging church pastorate than Tim Keel did. She did not plant Journey, but I asked her, how did she come to be the second pastor of that church?
I graduated from seminary, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I had a baby. Dan was really liking his job in New Jersey. We weren't quite ready to move. One of the people that I knew at Princeton was like, you know, there's this part-time job that's a chaplaincy for people primarily with Alzheimer's, and do you want to go and apply for this position? And I was like, well, I love elderly people, but I thought I was going to be working with 20-somethings going through what we now call deconstruction. So that seems weird. But I went, and yeah, within like 10 minutes, I just totally knew that was the next step. So it actually ended up being great because it helped me have space for big, hard things like grief and death. And I do think that that ended up really helping me as an emerging pastor because there was a lot of grief and death in people's understanding of how their faith was changing and what they lost in their families because of that. And so it actually ended up being a really wise choice, but it was great. And I always look really fondly on that. And then, yeah, so I got a call. I worked at another church. They asked me to start like a Sunday night worship service. And I was doing that. And then we had our son. And then I got a call that the Journey pastor called me, Scott, and he said that he was stepping down to do full-time counseling and that he had suggested that they reach out to me to consider applying for the position of pastor. And my husband looked at me and he was like, there's like two churches in the world that you would say yes to, and this is one of them. So I feel like you should probably just do it. I threw my name in the hat and got the job, and we moved to Dallas.
I asked Danielle about how she came to accept the job, what that day was like when they offered her the job to be pastor of Journey.
Well, it's funny, they called me, you know, it was quasi-Baptist. So it was, you know, I came in view of a call and did my sermon, and then they all decided to install me as the pastor. So I like left for them to vote. And it was my birthday. I left to vote. I was probably 27.
Dang, 27.
Yeah, so I walk in. I'm like, this is all I want for my birthday. They call, Luke Miller comes out and he says, you know, come on in, you're our new pastor. And so I come in and they were like, hey, we need to have a community meeting. We're having a community meeting right now. And I was like, in addition to the fact that you just called a new pastor? And they said, yeah, the church is kicking us out. So we got to figure out where we're going
to
go.
Wait, they didn't reveal that to you during the interview process?
I was like, they're kicking us out. Like, how long have we got? And we had like, you know, 2 months or something to find a spot.
Why were they kicking Journey out?
Well, so, you know, it's not their fault that they wanted this to be something that led to more Baptists in their church that were young. And of course, it didn't do that because the people that came to Journey had no interest in being like traditional Southern Baptists. And I totally get why they wanted it to be that way. And I also totally get why it didn't end up being that way. But that was kind of an impasse, right? So they said, you know, you've got to go figure out your own way. And that was the joke has been that I would never, if I went back, call it Journey, because I feel like I would want to name it like steady, consistent income or something that we wouldn't quite live into the metaphor so consistently. So that is how it started. And that kind of is a good metaphor for how it was. We were always on the move. So I think that's just, it's hard not to have that stability. I think that's one of the benefits that UBC had is that Chris got someone to give him money for that building. And it created that stability. And I think one of the hardest things about pastoring a church like that is that we were always moving. So we had a couple of months. I found a pastor that had this big church that they weren't using all of it. And he said, we've got this like fellowship hall. It has an outside door. Do you want to use that? It was a great little space. And I said, yeah, we'll take it. We could afford the rent.
How many people were coming to Journey at that time?
It was always fairly consistently like 50 or 75 on a Sunday. We probably had 100-ish that said that Journey was their church, and most of them showed up on a Sunday, but not all of them. I always joked that our lowest Sunday was like when South by Southwest was happening because they all just went to Austin, you know? So I was like, well, no one's here this week because that's happening. But we struggled a lot with having to do things like that. I think it was a lot of output on finding rental spaces. So we were in that space for a couple of years, and then they had kind of a pastoral turnover and needed us to go. And so then we rented a space that was costly, and it was an office park, and it didn't feel as church. You know, we actually wanted a church vibe. We just wanted to go in and put couches with the church vibe. And so the office was really not what we were going for, but it was a great space for the next, I guess, 4 years before we moved again. When I think about what it was like, I wouldn't change a thing. And also I get why we were all so tired, because pastoring a church like that just requires a lot of energy. It's nothing about that kind of service is plug and play, you know? My friends in mainline denominations, it's like, we're going to pick out two hymns, we're going to, the introit, you know, you got to, whatever. Like, it's all the same. Whereas every week we would meet and we would create this whole experience kind of from scratch. And as exciting as that was, and how that was exactly what I wanted it to be, it just is a way different level of creative output week after week. I think it's a very different thing to prepare for a conversation rather than a sermon. You just have to be ready for anything that can come up. So we had teaching team, which was open to anyone in the community that wanted to come. But we would meet on Wednesdays at lunchtime, and anyone who wanted to come and talk about what the scripture was and what the topic was could come and just sort of help me think about, or whoever, think about how to lead the conversation. And part of that was always like, well, what's going to come up, you know? And somebody would say, well, you know, Dallas is going to say this, or, you know, Chris is going to say this, or Jessica's going to bring this up, or Raylan's going to say this. And we would like just try to think about how best to honor the space of the whole conversation. And then we would, of course, think about, well, what liturgy goes with this? What music goes with this? What creative response can we do? So if that's body prayer, or, you know, doing something with soil or art, or I don't know, we just came up with stuff. What felt like it fit to what we were talking about, where we think it might go in a conversation. So fun. So fun to do that week after week. And also, you just don't get a break because every single week is like that, you know? Yeah. And then, you know, it was a group of people that we were all young and starting out in our careers. Most people were like teachers and nonprofit workers. So nobody was like, you know, a surgeon. We didn't have any like lawyers going. And so money was an issue and capacity for volunteering was an issue. But I think the thing that made us special is that it mattered so much to us that we all gave so much. Like, I can't think of a single person that didn't just give profusely to the life of Journey. And that's what made it so lovely.
Danielle knew that she had gotten into something very special, that Journey was unlike other churches, at least other churches that she'd experienced. That was my experience too. But she knew this was unique.
I just say every day, God, please don't let me mess this up. Like, what these people have and the commitment and love that they have for this place and for each other is so beautiful. I just don't want to do anything to dishonor that or mess it up. So we just all threw in and gave what we could and showed up and made cool stuff happen. And we did it with like $0, you know?
Were you full-time? Did you have benefits? Did you have any other, were there any other paid staff members?
So I came in part-time and that was actually fine because I did have two kids and we didn't have a nanny or childcare or, you know, things like that. So it was helpful for me to have some space. I certainly worked more than half time. We did have one person that sort of helped with some admin work for a little while, but that didn't last too long. So we all just sort of divvied it up. So really it was mostly just me. And it was a part-time thing. And I was super grateful that just because of how our family worked, that I was able to do that because a lot of people couldn't. So that was a gift. We were there because it mattered. Like nobody was doing this for their 401k or their resumes. We showed up and the band gave so much time. They were like creating music. You know, I mean, just everybody who did anything, all the people that were in leadership, you know, it was just a huge commitment. And I think that's maybe the thing that's so different than any other church that I know of is just the level of commitment that we had to each other. Like, we went to dinner every single week and we said, this is an extension of our worship time together, is that we do Journey and then we go out to eat. And then a lot of times after we went out to eat, we went out after that as well to Old Monk. And
had it grown to 200, would that have been possible?
We talked about that, and I think we knew that the thing that made it so special was how well we all knew each other, and that that did put, that's a blessing and a curse, right? Because people come in, and I do hope that they felt welcomed, but also they could tell that we were all really in it, you know? And sometimes that can be, you know, that can feel uninviting, even if we're trying to invite you into it. So I think it's a blessing and a curse, but we had an assumption that if we started to grow past a certain point, I think 200 was the point, that we would probably split into two services or do something, because there's no way to replicate that level of community if you get to be too big. I remember talking to friends of mine that were pastors of just big churches, and I was like, how do you do that? You know, this was my, you know, I got there at 27 or 28. This was my first foray into pastoring. And I didn't, the only way I knew how to do it was like knowing everything that was going on with people that they were willing to share and like praying for them and worrying about them and being super invested in their lives. Like I just fully went all into the whole, like, we're all here for each other. I was like, how do you do that when you have 1,000 people?
You don't. Yeah.
You don't. And I just, that was the thing to me that felt so valuable. I know that they would be there for me today and I would be there for them. Like the other day, something happened with the journey person. I was like, they're my ride or dies. Like I will show up for those people forever. Because you just don't leave relationships like that.
Did you have to do normal pastory things? Like, did you have to start a nursery when people started having kids? You didn't have like a mean organist you had to fire, but you know, little church conflicts, hospital visits, all those like pastory things. How much of those took place in this community?
It was very, very different. My favorite story about hospital visits is that Jen Wilson, who I've been friends with since freshman year at Baylor, also went to UBC. We hung out there. And then when I got to Journey, she had been there starting at the first Sunday. She was a longtime elder, has been a longtime friend of mine. Anyway, Jen called me and was like, hey, I'm just letting you know we're at the ER. So-and-so's in the ER. We're good. Just was going to let you know. But there's like 5 of us up here already, so we don't need you. Just wanted to let you know what was going on. And I was like, but okay, you know, it was so great because it was like they knew how to be church for one another and they just wanted to call and let their pastor know, but like they didn't need me to come up and do anything. They're already doing it, which is, gosh, like that's what every pastor wants, is for people to take seriously the fact that they show up if somebody gets in the ER, right? So it was a lot like that. You know, it was not like we've got to look to the pastor to do all the things. It was like, we're in this together and we're going to do it all together. Certainly there were skirmishes, you know, but I think, honestly, looking back, I think it's pretty remarkable how well we all got along. And if we had issues, we just talked about it. It was actually really healthy. Like we would just say, this is a thing we're dealing with. What are we going to do about it? And people would openly say, well, I don't think that's right. And I disagree with you. And we would just have these, I think because we had conversation all the time, it really helped with conflict communication because that was just the mode that our whole community was based on. So I just, in that sense, I'm like, I think churches could really learn from that because there's so much sort of negative backroom chatter that goes on in churches. And we just didn't have that. Like we would just have it out.
You did communion every week. Is that right?
Yeah.
Which is
not at the beginning, but okay. By the end. Yeah.
That's not a very Texas Baptist kind of thing to do. So what led to that decision?
Yeah. It's odd that at the end we sort of became a little Episcopalian. Like we realized that we settled into this rhythm that felt right for who we were becoming, and it did feel more liturgical than when we had started. It certainly was still Journey, but we had always started with a collect and with some quiet, and that was really valuable for us. We started to not mind using collects that other people wrote eventually. Maybe that's because I was tired of writing them every week, but you know, we realized, oh yeah, no, these things have been around because people have valuable things that they've written and that people have found useful. We sort of settled into a rhythm that felt right to us, but mm-hmm. communion was something that it came from the community. Like mm-hmm. a handful of the people said, it seems dumb that we don't do this every week. This is just the epitome of who we are as a people, is that we gather around a table and, you know, we're deeply sacramental. They had this whole theological argument for why Journey should do communion every week. And I was like, yeah, I'm down. I love that it was really open communion. So I was not the only one to preside at the table. Like we did not have any weird rules about any of that stuff. So anyone who was someone who you can say would honor the table, right? Somebody who we think would take it seriously enough could stand up and preside. And anyone could come. And that sense of openness, I think, was a good thing to make part of our liturgical life together. I miss that. That's the thing I think I miss most of all.
Why did you decide to leave? And what happened after you left?
Yeah. I've had years to think about this now. And I think in some ways, the fact of how much I needed to leave still feels like a mystery to me. I think it will endlessly be a paradox that I just look at in my life and say, that is what that was. What I can say for sure is that there is no job that I have had or probably will ever have that I loved more than being Journey's pastor. It was fulfilling in every single way. Even with all the hard stuff of like, we never have money and we've got to move and like, you know, people got older and they had less time to give. I mean, we had all the things, right? We did have to figure out what are we going to do with kids? I mean, just all the stuff. I wouldn't trade a single second of any of that. It was all so meaningful and valuable and worth it. And I also just realized, God, I cannot do this for one more second. I literally can't. And I think I fought that for like a year and a half. I was seeing my spiritual director, who's still my mentor and spiritual director, and she certainly wasn't going to tell me, but it just took a while for me to get the message. And the weird mystical thing that happened is that one day I was leading a conversation at Journey on a Sunday night, and a voice in my head was like, I swear, Danielle, if you do this for one more week... You know, it was just like a very come to Jesus moment where God was like, get the crap out of there. Like, we have danced around this enough. You got to go. And it was so jarring that I kind of lost my spot in the conversation. And I like forgot myself for a minute. I don't know if anybody else would have ever recognized that. But anyway, I got home that night and I was just so jarred inside because I did feel like it was my soul or whatever, God saying like, this is it. This is the end point. Like we can't wait for you to like decide. Cause I think I would have never decided. I just could have never decided that unless somebody was like, so I called Doug that night. Cause I was like, I think he's the only person in the world who understands how this could feel. And mm-hmm. I said, I really need to talk to you. Like, can we set up time to talk? And he said, wow, that's weird. I'm going to be in Dallas tomorrow. Do you want to have breakfast? Wow. And I was like, stupid Jesus. Like, what? Yes, I want to have breakfast. So we had breakfast the next day. And I said, I don't know how to say this, but I don't think I can be Journey's pastor anymore. And like, I'm already heartbroken about it. I don't know what, I know I have to, but I don't want to. And I just like, broke down, and he just, you know, sat with me and told me all the things, and I like never cry. Anyway, he sort of helped me figure out how to navigate that. So I told the community, they were so supportive. I said, I feel like it's time. I think it's time for me to go and I don't know what's next. And yeah, so we started transitioning me out. We were trying to see if there was a way for me to sort of be able to mentor the next Journey pastor, because it's a very, you don't learn this stuff in seminary, no. You know? So there's an on-ramp that requires a little bit of support. And it was going to be dicey for me to do that as the person who was the former pastor. And I knew that that was going to be weird, but I also said I would be happy to offer it. So anyway, it took a while to find someone. It's hard to take a job that is part-time and part pay and all of those things. You have to have a situation in your family that allows you to do that. And not a lot of pastors do. The person who took the job is a lovely, thoughtful, kind, open-hearted human being. I think maybe it was just time for Journey to go. So I tried to hang around and help. I realized that it wasn't helpful. I ended up leaving because I wanted to give it space to try to become what it was going to morph into. I think it's hard when people have so much love for a place. It's hard for it to change. And that is a way in which I think it's like every other church, right? I can have a lot of care for the churches that are like, we don't want it to change, because I think Journey was that way as well. And looking back, I think it just was time, right? We were all moving over a threshold into new seasons, and I will never not feel bad for the person that sort of put the kibosh on it, because it was like ending this really beautiful, lovely thing. And I also just, I think I didn't have another choice. So yeah. So after that, there were a few years that Journey was around, and it sort of winded down after that and ended up closing.
Finally, I asked Danielle if she thought that the life of Journey, the life of that little renegade, guerrilla, congregation in the midst of Dallas with all of its huge steeples and Bible churches, if she thought it made any difference in the life of Dallas, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, or even ecclesial life across America.
I do. I actually really do think that. There were so many churches that came and pastors that came and sat in the pews at Journey and took notes, right? And I think you have to open-handedly let that become what it is, and it's going to look different based on, you know, their denominational affiliation and where they are. And, you know, nobody was as quite all in as we were at Journey. And I will never not say that it's a good way of doing church, because I think it is. I think it's the most, I think it's the best way to form people. If you want to form people, you do something that feels like spiritual direction in a group. And that's what we did. And I think that the church would be better if we did more of it. I will never not say that. I see the fingerprints everywhere. I'm sad that so much of what we started specifically isn't still around, but I think the seeds and the insights and the creativity and all that energy that we had, I think that we did send that forth into the world with the best intentions, and I think it's still swirling around. I do.
Emerged is a homebrewed Christianity production. Trip Fuller and Tony Jones are your hosts. Production, mixing, and sound design by Josh Gilbert. Media and marketing by David Trotter. The music you're hearing is from the Cobalt Season, thanks to Ryan Sharp. Other music used is from Solomon's Porch, thanks to Ben Johnson, and of Journey Church, thanks to Z. Thanks to all our Emerged members who make the show possible. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time.
Just finished the second episode of the Emerged podcast. This crowd-funded production is a whole bunch of work, like cray-cray volumes. If you enjoy it, want to keep making it happen, and let us finish telling the story, head to emergedpodcast.com and join the community. There are people donating to make this podcast possible. And because they're helping us out, we give them all sorts of bonus features like ad-free versions of the public show, live streams on the off week, and bonus interviews. And this week you'll get to hear from the man Brad Cecil, the one with the PowerPoint that got in fetal position and tells some pretty wild stories. So come join up, emergepodcast.com. And guess what? You could be a producer. Like our friends at the Open Table Network and Karen Sloan. Don't make them lonely.